The topic that I endeavor to address is monumental, and it's total as it relates to the very fundamental nature of existence. Spiritual connections and obligations are at the very core of how young Tlingit people come into the world and begin to learn about their lives. A couple of key themes and concepts to start off with. Cosmology represents the understandings of the nature of existence itself, the entities, processes, interactions, and the nature of time and space relationships. There are other cosmologies, it's a universal facet of human cultural experience to account for ourselves in some fashion or other. One of the core principles of Tlingit cosmology is what we now call, as an academic term, cosmological cycling, and I'll have more to say about that. These living spirits, these entities that constitute one of the forms of existence, cycle between the domains of life and death as we know it, and that cycling is subject to appropriate treatment. So there have to be appropriate relations that ensure that these cycles persist. Connections is the very important part. These domains of existence are connected, and the spiritual forms in the domain of life are connected on a permeable and a semi-permeable basis with the other forms as well. Second to the connections is interdependence. Interdependence is absolutely at the heart. One of the things I like to teach to classes, I now use a concept of obligatory reciprocity. The Moiety system of Tlingit people requires the other. You must be interdependent. You cannot be Robinson Crusoe or some individual Ayn Randish person. You never think in that fashion. You always think of the other side and the necessity of that interdependence. So too, those relations are fundamental to the way in which spirits of all of us are related together. The relations then are foundational to the creation of the interdependence. And those relations include obligations. What obligations constitute what one must do to allow existence to continue. And this constitutes one of the core principles always, and that is respect. But the working out of the meaning of respect is very important and needs a lot of examination and continuous utilization and demonstration. These occur in all forms of life, but especially in the ritual and ceremonial life. So as Dr. Smythe mentioned, Tlingit beliefs, behaviors, and ritual practices are built on these basic principles, and they are oriented toward relational sustainability. I want to make a quick footnote here. I said on the interview on what we have is a fundamentally different view from that of a Western biblical or science-based construct in which the arrow of time goes forward. When a life is lived, it's gone, and a soul goes somewhere or another under Christian belief, or the physical remains disappear in a scientific belief. This is very different, and it implicates people's behaviors in very different ways because there's a responsibility that is inherent in terms of bringing about these changes. So at the foundation then, we have a series of understandings that are given to us in the accounts, the oral traditions, the sacred accounts that are associated with the transformation that Raven or Hiel brought about. And you can see in the background some of the aspects that I'll mention here quickly as we go through this. But another important aspect of Tlingit thought, which relates a little more to how people are now investigating the ancestry, this chart shows on the bottom the relative sea levels. And that dark line at the top shows where sea level is currently at, and where the little bulge goes above, that's when sea level was much higher, and it was establishing beach strands up here. Tlingit clans and people have accounts of deep time that deal with a flood. And this is quite possibly the time then in which the ancestral occurrence of the flood may well correspond with these geological understandings. But Raven's creations are fundamental to how we exist. And of course, the classic story of the releasing of the sun, moon, and stars from the head of the Nass River, where they were held by the power of the man, is a crucial story, because it tells us that in deep time, it gives us one of the key understandings. At that time, all of the animals and the fish appeared as other people. This is the critical understanding that will gets carried forward from this account. And they would put on their clothing, which is their outside. And when light came on, the major transformation that occurred was that they no longer took off their skins and their feathers anymore. But that did not change the deep essence. The deep essence of their spiritual personhood is still manifest. Another of Raven's stories is that he had obtained fresh water for all beings from Dekinu, which is Far Out Fort. And I had the joy of visiting Far Out Fort with the now past Clarence Jackson some years ago, who would speak with great eloquence of this location. This is the location in Tlingit thought, particularly of southern Tlingits, from which fresh water came. And Raven flew over the landscape, and it dribbled out of his mouth and became rivers and streams. And there is still a spring on those islands that Clarence said he went to that is there. This is another important point about the spatial location of the actual occurrences and the return of Tlingit people to those special landscape areas to be able to encounter these very, very deep time phenomena. It's located in the Hazy Islands, which sits about 15 miles west of Coronation Island in southern southeastern Alaska. And of course, Raven was also brought forward King Salmon. He tricked King Salmon into jumping onto the beach near Lituya Bay. And I was given an account by a Tlingit elder, now deceased, about his discovery of the Raven's footprints on the beach outside Lituya Bay, where this particular event occurred as well. in addition tricking the king salmon, Raven is also responsible for hauling in the tank from the ocean and releasing all of the species of fish. And this too is considered to have occurred in the ocean off of northern southeastern Alaska. And he also convinced Owl to get fire from the ocean, from the fireball. And this is another wonderful piece of Tlingit linkage. This is a petroglyph that exists now in Klawak, in the Totem Park, that was originally on Shanda, or Fishag Island. And it's a mnemonic device. I have a video in which Clara Pravatrovich explains the way in which this demonstrates how Owl's beak burned as he went out to the ocean and got the fireball and came back in. So this is actually a part of Tlingit pedagogy, how one passes these traditions on and ensures that the young people have them embedded within them. The final incident that I wanted to mention is also that Raven's responsible for the creation of the tide, in which he was able to trick the old woman who controlled the tide into releasing the tide so he could go down below. And this is part of an at'u, a tunic worn by the Duk Den Tan, and this activity is thought to have occurred in the Indian Islands. So what lessons do we obtain from this particular category of deep oral traditions, which I can consider to be of a quality of sacred understandings that are the equivalent of biblical type accounts? First of all, we learned that the movement between domains of existence occurs, so that this is possible. It may only be possible by some, but it does occur. Movement between forms of existence occurs, that forms transformations can occur. These have implicit messages that are carried in life. Things may not be as they appear, so one must pay attention for the deeper parts of what is at present. There may be deeper meanings than those that are apparent beyond our present understandings. There's the implicit message as well to be observant, to be attentive, to be open to new knowledge. And there's also the implicit message, which are that unbridled expressions of desire can be a problem. as those usually are some of Clinkett's views on ravens' behaviors. So the thing at home is sacred, as we can see through the place names, through the locations, the actions of Raven in bringing about these transformations is here, is apparent, is within this landscape and now. It's not at a distance, not an abstraction. It is grounded in people's understandings of their own places. And we can see this in the extraordinary work that has been done to document by Tlingit scholars the place names throughout southeastern Alaska that ground those experiences and make those all available to others. So now we want to turn and talk about this other very important aspect of how indeed cosmological cycling occurs as we refer to it as. And in this particular respect, we find that in English, this is sometimes termed rebirth or reincarnation. And in Tlingit belief, reincarnation follows the clan, and it follows a house, often and almost always the sex. So that if a female elder dies, we'll expect her spirit to return through her name in a subsequent dimension, in subsequent time, in the same clan and same line. Unlike in other places in the world, even in other Alaska Native societies, there's no crossing of species or moving into other kinds of populations. This particular process has critical underpinnings that have to do with how the body, the spirit, and the mind are occurring in this particular life. It requires the relief of the spirit of death through cremation. So in traditional society, that act of cremation, which occurs 4 days, releases the spirit so that it can begin its journey to return. And this allows it to leave the living world to prepare for return. The kuwake, which occurs at some time later, is the memorial ritual that not only does away with grief and accomplishes many other cultural objectives, but spiritually it accomplishes the opportunity for the return so that the new names can now be brought back. And Tlingit life then is rich in the identification of who and when will they return. This comes through various different channels, through dreams, through visions, and in the past, the Ixtr, the shaman, was very important, using his mechanisms to identify who is going to be returning. And as that person comes back, they will then be examined and listened to for the kinds of knowledge that they have, for the kinds of tastes and the kinds of skills. All of these things bring together and undergird the notion of the return of the spirit. So it's the obligations of the living. These things must be carried out toward the spirit, and these must be in order for that spirit to return. This is why there is also a horror within Tlingit society, and it's also shared in higher society, the horror of drowning and not having the body recovered. Because it's in the cremation that the freeing of the spirit to return. So if the body is not recovered, spirit cannot be released, the likelihood is that they may be going into another domain, a domain of spiritual power that is challenging in a place that you don't want to be. And that being is called the Kushtika. And so those landowner men are in fact locations why there is such huge investment, great grief shown over the notion of drowning, and people will spend so much time. So this is then just a little indication of what cosmological cycling is about. It's the movement from birth through life to death, and then the passage through death until the spirit is called again and makes its way back into this world. And these particular notions are codified in three very important Tlingit concepts: the concept of shuka, which mentions and brings forth the names for the past, the joint heritage of the past, present, and future members of the clan, this unbreakable ties and bounds. The present generation have the obligation of acting as the trustees to ensure that existence for themselves and those in the future who return will be possible. Shagun is the remembering and the honoring of persons that have gone before who have had special and meaningful experience for clan members. And the other critical concept and relationship is that of At'u. And these are the sacred objects and practices which embody and memorialize ancestral experiences and claims to territory, resources, and relationship. Virtually all At'u have as part of the sacred carry that they have is through the sacrifice, the loss of a person's life in the context of those particular occurrences. This then gives rise to the relational cosmology. A relational cosmology has the ontology of the existence composed of willful, sentient spirits and forces. This is very important to understand, and I'll use another concept here. It is respect and interdependence in this relational cosmology that are crucial. And the continuity of existence depends upon relational principles of mutual benefit, respect, and giving. It is not theistically given. It's not based upon a determinate set of doctrines. It's based upon sets of understandings that are derived from those other core materials that we'll listen to. And it's not materialistic. It's not based upon any sort of scientific dogma. It is indeed relational at its core. And one of the other really crucial founding documents, critical documents in Tlingit existence, is the relationship with salmon, because salmon are indeed fundamental and central and absolutely at the foundation of Tlingit life in its traditional practice. And this is given to young Tlingit people in a mythic charter. And that by mythic charter, I mean it establishes the principles of relationship. Just like the Magna Carta establishes principles of relationship, the Akwetat Sin story establishes principles of relationship that are absolute. And this story is a story in which a young human being begins by disrespecting and throwing down a piece of dried fish. This is an absolute abomination or a sin in the context of other discussions. He then heads out of the house as his mother expresses her dismay, falls into the water, and would have drowned except that he was saved by the salmon people. The head of the salmon people saw him and took the boy down to the home of the salmon people, which he discovered was deep off the shores of the water. And there he saw the salmon people as people like himself, without their skins. And he spent a year there. And he learned, this is very important, he learned from the head of the salmon people. Salmon people taught him. And that's the important principle. One of the principles is this is how you gain knowledge, is by attending to all of these other spiritual forms that are in your midst. And then he was required to come home. It's time to return to the stream, the head of the salmon people said. And so they got into their canoes. And as they headed back, as they approached the stream where his mother and father were, he was told to stand up to see where they are. But because he was in a canoe, when he stood up, he jumped out of the water. He jumped out of the water in front of the stream where his parents were. And then he gave himself to his father, showed himself and gave himself to his father. And his father took the fish and gave it to his mother. And she opened his slits and discovered the copper necklace that had been on him at the time in which he went out and was drowned. They then knew something was quite different. They asked the shaman, what should we do? The boy was put up. The shaman said, put him up overnight. He transformed, became the young boy again, and began the process of teaching the people what he knew, and from then on became a very powerful shaman himself. So this story demonstrates some of those key principles. Core principles about cosmological cycling, the return of the spirit. Non-human entities has an essential spirit of person that is the same as humans. And that the ahune, or respect, the existence depends upon reciprocal, respectful relations. And that's what the young boy taught. Part of that teaching was the ritual relations, including the return of salmon bones to the water, and these are critical as part of that mythic charter. So Tlingit concepts and practice derived from this mythic charter include the notion of respect, which I mentioned, that salmon are to be understood as people, that they are sentient, means they feel. They are capable of sensing as we do. They are attentive. They know how they are treated, and they are have inherent dignity, as all people do, and so they must be treated with respect. They are volitional, meaning that they can make choices, and so they will choose to return to those who respect and carry them with dignity. And they have powers themselves, just like human beings. This particular quotation from Elder Joe Hotch of the Chilkatquan demonstrates one of the fundamental behaviors that derives from that particular mythic charter. And he says, one of the first things about this principle of respect in the relationship is acknowledgement and affirmation. So Joe says, when they are jumping, we are supposed to say, "Ayo." So as a young man, when I was out on the boats, as a very young man, Tlingit captains, and I'd hear them say, "Ayo." What the hell is that? You know, that means jump. Well, it doesn't mean jump. It's the affirmation and the acknowledgement of your presence. I recognize that you are coming to us. And in I.O., they keep knowing they're being appreciated, and that is what respect is about, the continuous stream of appreciations that are continuously passed on. And so they keep jumping, just keeping saying I.O., and that's the way they want to be talked to. The fish want to be appreciated like human beings. I won't go into the philosophical positioning, but you constantly examine yourself. This is a reflexive principle in that particular way about yourself and the other in this particular case. Now, we can also see this, and I began an understanding of this particular phenomena, which the previous examiners of this particular object, which sits in the Burke Museum, it's a carved stake that was attached, as you can see to the left, on an intertidal weir. And it was attached in such a fashion that it was above the water. And if you look carefully at the stake, you will see that it is in fact a carving that replicates the salmon boy story. Because what you have is the salmon on the outside, and the inside is the boy or a person. Well, now what might this particular stake, in its context, and it was reported to have been on a weir like this, what might we gain from an understanding of it? Well, some people said, well, it was just demonstrating that these are the people who the salmon are to come back to. Well, who can see this stake? Who is the stake positioned to be able to see? Who will see it? The salmon jumping out of the water are the ones who will see it. They'll be the ones who will see it. And what will they see? Will they simply see a mnemonic device that indicates we who you are coming to know the salmon boy and will treat you with respect? Is it that lesson that is being conveyed? Perhaps that's a part of the lesson that's being conveyed, and I won't, I think that's an important part. But there's another thing about respect and about all of Tlingit ritual and ceremonial life, and that's its aesthetic quality. Because you're not looking at something that is just dashed together, and you're not looking at something that is put up in a wall or in a house. You're looking at something that is a beauteous object that is a gift. It is a gift to the salmon that is a part of the extension of the respect into another domain. And so too, in part of the accounts of the return of the salmon, elders in Kluwak would say that they would go out to those streams in their traditional regalia, and they would sing songs at the time of that return. And then they would engage in a first salmon welcoming ceremony. So within the Akwetatsin Charter, the concepts that we've discussed are salmons as personal, sentient, volitional, attentive to human acts, dignifying, requiring the respect, and the return depends upon the upon rituals, ritual actions. Now, several years ago, I was had the great honor to conduct a study on traditional ecological knowledge amongst elders in Huna and Klawa. And some of these principles that were given to me are also part of the behaviors that are derived. In each case, those elders would tell that story in response to the question, what were you taught about salmon? That story was given to them. All of those represent the very important practices that they are supposed to be engaged in. Each of these are one of these kinds of practices. Utilize all, no waste, never speak badly, do not play with fish, and share with others. All of these constitute principles derived from that, which continue to be very powerful in Thlinkit life today. And in Klawak, at the first salmon feast, were held upon the arrival of the sockeye. The entire community was invited, and the host clan harvested fish, roasted them in a pit, and fed everybody. The clan leader collected the salmon bones after consumption and returned them to the estuary where the stream flowed out. This was part of the lessons that was taught by in the salmon boy story. He sang to them to travel safely down to their homes and return as the bones drifted back out. So singing is another way of the identification of respect. So these constitute ritually prescribed actions to ensure the rebirth of the salmon and hopefully their return based upon how the individuals have acted. Now, this particular phenomena that I want to come back to is a phenomena of what we refer to as reflexivity, which reflexivity is a way of looking at how your engagement and how your experiences can be used to interpret those others. And this is a constant premise that we see. How do I use what I know to be able to know how to behave? And so when salmon come back, Thlinkit people are out there. They're watching them just as they watch them jump and they say, "Ayo." How else can we express our relationship that will be about sustaining the relationship, to bring about the return? And this concept had not been explored until Rosita was able to, when she read this, she saw this is significant. And the scholars came together and talked about this particular concept. The elders that I interviewed had used this concept and word in both communities, the concept of ish. And they used that word because there was no identifiable English correlate to all of its deep meanings in the context of Thlinkit traditional ecological knowledge and spiritual life. So it's a multidimensional relational concept. It first of all, and you will say at the first level, it references a deep pool in a stream. And I'll come back to that point. But it also references something more pragmatic. Ritual and belief don't necessarily preclude the pragmatics in terms of how they are tied together. And I use the term sight index. What does that mean? Elder Sam Hanlon told me that as a young man, when the salmon were returning, he would be taken out by his grandfather, and his grandfather would get off the boat when he could see the salmon coming to a stream, and he would walk up that stream until he came to the first ish. And he would see if the first ish was full of fish. If the first ish was full of fish, then they could start fishing. If it was not, they would have to move on. Now, there's some other people who would call that conservation. I don't call it conservation because it derives from a different foundation of relationship. But nevertheless, it is a sight index to ensure that the salmon get to their homes. That's the premise. Home is where things are absolutely fundamental. During spawning time, it is a place of rest and recuperation. It's a harvesting location. It's a spawning location. It's a site of modification. And it's a location of philosophical contemplation. Because salmon are so central. When Thlinkit watch salmon all the way back and all the way up, creating their homes, and they see lots of things along the way that relates to their own experiences. They see as the salmon come through the shallows, they move very fast. They go through the riffles very rapidly. When they come to the falls, they see that they have to exert enormous energy. Tremendous energy is exerted to get up those falls, to get back to their homes where they can spawn. And along the way, there are the issues. There are the deep holes, the deep holes. And in the deep holes, they can observe and see the salmon. This is where they regenerate. This is where their energy comes back to themselves. This is their place of solemn contemplation. Because what salmon are contemplating is that on the other side of these actions, I will die. So in that particular moment of contemplation, the idea of the ish is born as a special place where perhaps we should indeed create more ishes. Maybe we should create more ishes to make it possible for salmon to have more locations to do this. And this is what an ish is. An ish is a pool where you have falls above, riffles below, eddies on the side, and this is how the salmon boy name is in fact translated. It's translated as alive in the eddy. So here again is another reference to the crucial role that the ish plays in understanding reflexively all of that effort. They need a place to rest. And in that place to rest, they are considering what their futures are going to be consist of. I went back to the, and you'll find this particular appearance symbolically in a number of places that had previously not been identified. But when I was back at the University of Pennsylvania, I found what was called the salmon staff. And the salmon staff, which is about so long, comes from Sitka, probably by the clan that had the salmon boy story. And it has carved on it salmon figures, but in between the salmon figures are these ovals. There are three ovals inside of each other. And immediately when I saw that salmon staff, I said, that's the ish. The ish is given its representation in the context of the salmon staff. Well, what does an ish look like? Well, there's a gorgeous real-life ish, and it comes from the Neva River. And I was taken to this location by members of the Mills family, whose father's side are the clan owners of this particular stream. And although there are other locations on the stream in which we can see the physical relocation of stones. Stones have been moved from their areas to create open watered areas. And they've created for one of that purposes is to create a better gaffing ground. But it is built upon this premise that the salmon will come and be in that location because they value it. Well, as I stood by this particular location and I looked at that beautiful thing and I looked at the little falls that ran across it, behind me the brother said to me, "We're not the first ones on this stream." And so what we see then is that these stones have been reorganized from this area above to create the small falls and behind it to create the ish. And so when I spoke to the, came back several years later, this was an optimal time. This is an optimal time in which the water level and the salmon could get over that easily into that ish. But several years later, when I returned to Huna and spoke with the trustees of the stream, and he said to me, "You know that ish? When I was back there this year, the water was so low, I had to move the rocks so that the fish could get up." So it's not like it just is built in there. It's a constant monitoring. You constantly monitor what it is. And the next time I came back, he said, "Steve, you know what I did? I figured out a way so that the pool can equilibrate. When water is low, there'll be a path up, but otherwise it will be able to hold it." So it's this constant attention to the environment that you're in and the reaction to how that environment is received by others that's so important. And so the honored Walter Sobolev, in the context of the scholarly discussion that was held on this concept, he said the following, which speaks to this fundamental spiritual essence and communication. "There were those who were knowledgeable about all kinds of subjects. This thing named ish, it was almost as if it were human. and he is conveying its spiritual essence. And it was spoken to in that way, speaking in respect to it. That is how they valued this resource. It was as if their life depended on it, so they treated it with respect. Because they got their food from this place is why they would speak to it. There was pride, there was honor given to the Ish, so no one was to say anything foolish about it. It was said that we could laugh at it. It was not so. We were told not to talk in a foolish way, but to respect it. This is what white men calls taboo. When you do this, there is a discipline, a law that will correct you. It will be like it falls on you. This is the way this is. And that is seen around us, said to be alive or around us, what it is called. Tlingit people have known this to be true from time immemorial. So what we have here is the philosophy of Ish. But the philosophy of Ish is an expression of that fundamental relational sustainability. It is the basis for Tlingit engagement with salmon. At the top here is a renowned Western philosopher, a man known as Alfred North Whitehead, in which he says, "The true mark of philosophical construction is to frame a scheme of ideas the best that one can and unflinchingly explore the interpretation of experience in terms of that case." And James Osborne, one of my beloved Huna Elder sources, said at the very start of our interview, with great passion, "You have to understand that we treat salmon like we would like to be treated." And so this constitutes then what it means in terms of the lives of people, how deeply these things are embedded from children and how deeply they are carried forward throughout their life. Now these particular relationships are also present on landscape. The landscape is also a deeply spiritualized place which carries with it connections and foundations. One of the most important for Tlingit people was the role of the Ixt and the shaman. And unlike other people, the shaman was not cremated, but he was instead buried. And his burials, those burials are in very special places. There's one right down here on a point that's called Indian Point, that, as those of you who live in Juneau know, has been a matter of great Tlingit expression of the power of that place and the significance of that place and the willingness to fight for this vision of how that landscape is spiritualized and meaningful. These things are part of that. These are important, but they also carry with them a certain amount of danger. And that's very important, therefore, that they not be bothered in any particular way, in any particular fashion. Spiritualized places are often a combination between natural and constructed elements. And there are also naturally powerful sites. Lituya, with its tectonic and spiritual forces, is known to have a great spiritual power. The Indian Islands whirlpools, where spirits reside and can be of danger. And the glaciers around the world, and the locations of materials. I had the experience several years ago of being part of looking at this unbelievable location. This is a cave on the outer coasts of a ocean-fronting island in southeastern Alaska. And inside that cave, there are 70 pictographs. Pictographs are paintings, as opposed to petroglyphs, the carvings. 70 of them on these walls. And those depict many aspects of the stories about Raven that I'm talking about other particular events, but they also include some very powerful and important images. And these are images associated with shamanic spirits. And it is quite likely, in my judgment, that this was one of the locations where shamans would retreat to acquire and seek the spiritual power. So this is a spiritualized place that is a combination of some unique qualities. One of the things about this cave that it has is it has naturalized flow rock. Most of our caves down there are shale type caves that drift. But behind here is natural flow rock. And the Tlingit artist used the outlines and the features of that flow rock to lay on top their pictographs. So there's a merging of the natural and the spiritual together. Other extraordinary places that are highly spiritualized, and my honor to the people from Hunna who may be here, as this image I think is an iconic representation, and it comes from the lower portion of Glacier Bay, and of course this is the Tlingit homeland and the great stories of relationship here, and the failure to follow the accounts with regard to the treatment of spirits in a respectful way, and the outcomes, what happens in the outcomes of the faith. And those lessons are very important. But this is an iconic statement, because as you enter this landscape, you must speak respectfully to the glaciers, that you are coming into their home, that you are going to be there. And so we have this elder on his canoe, pulling up on the beach, and he is sitting making his remarks there to that iceberg, making sure that they all understand that he's coming. And so recently when I was going with the people of the Yaktat Kwan up to Hubbard Glacier, so too as we advanced up to Hubbard Glacier, the elders, George Ramos and Elaine Abraham, required the boat to stop, and before anybody landed, that there were speeches and offerings to the glaciers because of their enormity, of their power, and the significance of their being in the land of the glaciers. These are part of the spiritualized relationships that must be continued. And at the far upper end of Dishanchanson Bay, the research that we've been doing there is to try to identify and recover information about the seal camps. They found it, so you can reapply for it. This is a seal camp at the top that was first documented by a Harriman expedition in 1899, and as a result of the bottom picture shows recent archaeological research that has identified now as a result of tectonic uplift where those original camps were located. And this is the archaeological excavation that shows the rocks that were the basis for the keeping the tents down. And the excavation includes maps of various different materials. Now, in talking to the elders before we went up to that location, one of the things that I was told by Elaine Abraham is of the, and I heard it also in Cake, and there are other places, and other people in here certainly know, is the power of crystals. Crystals are a especially powerful form of rock, crystallized rock. And as she said, there is a sacred location at the head of Disenchantment Bay from which these could be acquired if one was appropriately trained and had the appropriate ritual activity. And so in the process of this excavation, lo and behold, look what appeared. Two of these pieces of crystal were found amongst large amounts of beads and other kinds of materials maintained and sustained by the people. So these our moral obligations. Tlingit cosmology and the practice it generates creates a behavioral orientation of keen and careful attention to one's environment in order to identify important indicators. In its emphasis on the necessity of respectful relations between spiritual forms, all similar in essential ways to humans, as the Akwetatsin mythic charter demonstrates, a direct attention to one's own behavior as important in ensuring continuity and avoiding disruption. Disruption can occur. The Castine story in Glacier Bay is a demonstration. While the basic principles as enunciated in the mythic charters are taught, modeled, and emphasized in Tlingit pedagogy, part of that training concerns the responsibility of the person to continuously return to the teachings for guidance and application to current conditions. That most definitely includes Yale. I don't know how many people, I can't enumerate them, of my dear Tlingit friends and Haidas have told me of their encounters with Raven and the attention Raven has brought to them about specific kinds of phenomena and events. This is a part of the behavioral environment and the attentive structure that this particular set of fundamental cosmological and spiritual relations brings about. To demonstrate respect, one must carefully control one's own actions, and most importantly, determine how to behave in a manner that will be perceived by others as an authentic expression of respect in all of those domains. That is the way in which the tapestry of respect is built. And if I have a minute, I'll tell a final story of relationality and the benefits of relationality and this attentiveness. Many years ago in Cloaca, I went out in the spring with the mayor, dear friend of mine, Bill Woods, who was great. He loved the research on the fish traps. He liked to be out there and showing the things that we were looking at. He said, Steve, we're going to go out and we're going to see if we can catch a king salmon. So we went out into this area, backside of the Alberto Islands. If anybody's here, famous king salmon run down there. As we made the turn around the corner to go down the track, Bill had his poles out and he looked up and he glanced at the island on the opposite side on the order of a half mile away, and he saw an eagle high up there down at the end of the run, way down there, single bald eagle. You know how they sit and they look. And what they understand about eagles have enormously good eyesight. And then not merely eyesight across the land, but they can see through water as well, much better than we can. And he's seeing that eagle, and as we pass down, he says, Steve, we're going to catch king salmon here. So away we went down that pass. Pretty soon we're down there. Bang! Fish on the line. Boom! Bill's playing that fish, gradually bringing that fish in. It's a beautiful king salmon. He ultimately puts down the net, picks it up, brings it in, lays it out very carefully in the appropriate Tlingit fashion. Then he begins cutting the slit down the stomach, and he pulls out the innards, the insides, puts them in his hand, walks to the side of the boat, and he holds them up, and he points them in the direction of the eagle sitting down there. And then he takes them and he throws them overboard like that. And then within less than a minute, that eagle left that tree, and it flew down, and it picked up those innards, and it flew off. And as it flew off, Bill said, Gunalshish, thank you, brother. Relationality is at the core of how you conduct your life. And if you want to benefit from it, you will remember that. So in closing, I would like to say thank you, express my deepest appreciation to all the Tlingit elders who have over the years provided opportunities for me to learn from them in so many ways, such as the way I just talked about. And it's in those places where the learning occurs best. I know I could have learned much more. It has been a richly rewarding and humbling journey along which I have traveled to the limited understandings I have obtained. And again, I'd like to extend my thanks to Dr. Rosita Worrell and the Sea Alaska Heritage for the invitation to present these remarks. I feel honored to have been invited to discuss these matters of such profound importance to Tlingit existence as I have come to understand it. Gunalshish.